Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio. My name is Valerie Bowling, and I'm the producer of the show. Pharma Talk Radio is a not-for-profit program organized by the Conference Forum to disseminate helpful information to all of those involved in helping get therapeutics to patients faster. I'm pleased to share insights today from Dr. Anna Pavlik, Director of the Melanoma Program at the NYU Cancer Institute, on safety elements of cancer immunotherapies. The topic of safety elements of cancer immunotherapies was originally featured at the IO 360 conference in June 2015. The next IO 360 program will take place February 2nd and 3rd, 2016, at the New York Academy of Medicine in New York City. For more information, the website is www.theconferenceforum.org. Dr. Pavlik's talk focuses on immune-related adverse effects of immunotherapy, and I would like to thank Dr. Pavlik for allowing us to share this very important session. Thank you.
But I was invited to speak about the safety elements of cancer immunotherapies because clearly as we evolve our therapies and go from single-agent monotherapy to dual targets to even triple combinations, our side effects increase exponentially, and so we have to be prepared on how to manage those effectively. So, what exactly are the immune-related adverse events? Well, I try to tell patients and their families and the interns and residents that an itis or any inflammatory side effect is a potential side effect from an immunologic toxicity. So, colitis, pneumonitis, meningitis. The symptoms are contingent on the agent. All agents do not give you the same side effects, and all combinations also don't exacerbate the same side effects. It's not routine to treat patients with pre-medications, again, because not all patients experience these adverse events. Unlike chemotherapy, where we know that nausea and vomiting are expected, we pre-medicate. With the immunotherapies, we just treat as the adverse events occur. But clearly, the key to intervention is early reporting and early intervention. So when we talk about immune-mediated side effects, we have to look at the time to onset. And again, this is a chart that really looks at monotherapy, and especially for ipilimumab. And you can see colitis is the most common, as well as the dermatitis with the rash and itching. Interestingly, the endocrinopathies that occur, such as the hypophysitis or the thyroiditis, usually occur around week 11 or 12. And in thinking in how you administer ipilimumab, it's one dose every 3 weeks. Patients are really completing their therapy on week 10. So these adverse events are happening long after therapy is over. And so you have to be very astute in order to make sure that you continue to monitor for these things. I will bring up the fact that this is monotherapy, and when we give combination therapy with ipilimumab and a anti-PD-1, this really accelerates the onset of these endocrinopathies, and it's not unusual to see these endocrinopathies happen very, very quickly within the first month or two of therapy. So, what are these immune-mediated toxicities? Well, number one, skin rash. Patients can have rash, they can have itching. They can have itching and rash together, they can itching and rash separately. I think the most bothersome side effect for most patients is the fact that they can develop itching without the rash because they truly think that it's all in their head and they're not going to call and report it because they have no rash. In very severe cases, you can get a Stevens-Johnson-like syndrome. Early reporting is key. I have actually experienced a patient with a Stevens-Johnson from ipilimumab, and the patient swore to me that there was nothing different with her rash. However, in a matter of week, when she came back into my office, she was essentially sloughing her skin and said that, well, all my rashes usually peel like sunburns, so she didn't think twice about it. The gastrointestinal side effects, including colitis, abdominal bloating, the potential for bowel perforation, are clearly important because, again, early intervention can determine whether or not a patient has bowel perforation. If diarrhea, especially profuse diarrhea or bloating or even ileus, is ignored, these patients can go on to perforate. Drug-induced hepatitis was mentioned here as well, and is clearly exacerbated with the administration of more than one agent. The endocrinopathies, I think, are the most particularly difficult for most practitioners to deal with, again, because these are not things that we're commonly brought up to learning how to focus on. The hypophysitis is usually a patient who presents with an excruciating headache somewhere either after therapy or in the middle of therapy, and clearly, being a melanoma doc, the first thought always has to be rule out a brain met. And so you're going to be sending these patients for MRIs, but you have to keep in mind that this is probably hypophysitis, if not a brain met, and so you want to make sure that when you do your MRI, the MRI has very thin sections through the pituitary so you can actually make the diagnosis, and you'll see a big inflamed pituitary gland on your MRI. Thyroiditis, most patients will usually develop hyperthyroidism, which will then burn out and become hypothyroidism. The hyperthyroidism is usually only detected on serology, and patients are usually completely asymptomatic no matter how low their TSH goes. On the converse, it's very, very evident to patients when they become hypothyroid because they become very sluggish, very fatigued, and really start to gain weight. And adrenal insufficiency, again, that's a diagnosis that you have to keep in mind. It's exceedingly rare, but you have to think about it. The pneumonitis particularly was made evident with the anti-PD-1 inhibitors. Again, shortness of breath on exertion, a non-productive cough. These are things that patients may just mention to you in passing that may, in fact, be very significant. The other side effect is uveitis, as well as episcleritis. We don't really focus too much on this, but the more that you use these agents, the more that you do see these adverse events, and patients will come in complaining of blurred vision. With episcleritis, they come in with eyes that look like two maraschino cherries, and that's really pretty obvious. Both are very easily treated with corticosteroid eye drops. And so, again, this is a character slide showing the immune-mediated toxicities. Again, what's the incidence? And this is single-agent ipilimumab. Pretty low, and which is another reason why we don't normally pre-treat prior to therapy. And so how do we manage it? Education is really the key to managing any immunotoxicity from any agent, whether it be an anti-CTLA-4 or an anti-PD-1. We tell patients that no call is a stupid call. We actually have our office staffed with a nurse for 8 hours while we're open just to take phone calls because we have so many patients on clinical trials with dual therapies that they will actually spend 8 hours on the phone managing combination therapy toxicity. Early consult, if you really think someone's got colitis and they're not responding to steroids, they may need to have a colonoscopy. They may need to see an endocrinologist if, in fact, they have hypophysitis because they will need to have lifetime permanent replacement of thyroid hormone, steroid hormones such as hydrocortisone because their adrenal function will be completely blown out as well, in addition to sex hormones. And so that's something that I have an endocrinologist who's always on standby for me to send someone over. And how do you intervene? Well, intervention is always with steroids. Fortunately, we found out that the easiest way to ameliorate all of these side effects is with corticosteroids, but fortunately, this corticosteroids that we use for the management of these toxicities does not impair the efficacy of the drug. And I think it's very important that patients and their families also understand that if they get a side effect, the side effect is not a reflection of the activity of the drug on their tumor. And there was a big understanding in the beginning that very much like when you get an EGFR receptor inhibitor, if you get a rash, it means the drug is going to work. Well, in the beginning, many patients didn't even want to report adverse events because if I stop the adverse event, well, then I'm going to stop the drug from working on the tumor. So I really try to make it very clear to patients that toxicities do not equate to responsive tumor. And likewise, lack of side effects also don't mean that you're not going to have a tumor response. And this is an example of what some of the rash can look like. The rash can be localized or it can be diffuse and generalized over the patient's entire body. And like I said, it can be just a maculopapular rash or it can be associated with itching. So how do we manage them? And again, I think we talked a little bit about that, but early intervention is key. The sooner patients can speak to us and tell us that things are going on, we can give them some topical things like topical Benadryl, topical corticosteroids. Oatmeal baths are also very soothing and helpful to patients before we actually even have to go on to give them oral corticosteroids. When it comes to diarrhea, we try to talk to patients about dietary management, how they need to take dairy and raw vegetables out of their diet, and really eat a very bland mashed potato and turkey diet. If, in fact, that doesn't help, then we revert to corticosteroids. Corticosteroids are given in the form of prednisone or dexamethasone or any of the oral steroids of your choice. Being the melanoma doctor and having half of my patients on dexamethasone for their brain mets, Decadron is my drug of choice. However, the rule of thumb is 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day of prednisone usually gets things under control. It's important to know that once you get these symptoms under control, however, you can't just quickly taper off the steroids over a course of a week or two. These adverse events need to be managed slowly, and if you taper too quickly, you're going to wind up with a flare, and you're going to have to re-escalate your steroids. So slow and steady wins the race. Taper your steroids over a course of 3 to 4 weeks. But what happens if you have a toxicity that's resistant to steroids? One of the things that can happen is drug-induced hepatitis, and many times we can try and treat the hepatitis picture as an outpatient because the patient is asymptomatic. But we have to monitor these patients very closely, and if, in fact, their liver function tests continue to escalate and they start to impact their bilirubin, they have to be hospitalized, be given IV steroids and mycophenolate as well. I think the one that we really have to face most commonly is colitis. Patients who have steroid refractory colitis are treated with infliximab, which is a TNF antagonist, routinely given for inflammatory colitis. Works very nicely. Usually one dose at 5 milligrams per kilogram of infliximab will take care of your colitis. However, I must admit that in patients that are now being treated with dual agents, such as anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1, they are requiring more than one dose of infliximab if, in fact, they develop colitis. And we talked about Stevens-Johnson, where that's just nothing that you ever really want to see, and when you do see it, you're just calling 911 and sending them to the local burn unit. So again, how do we manage it? Well, again, it's pretty much what I've told you. It's patient education and family education. Again, the key is also to make sure that family members will tattle on their patient because many patients, again, will not be forthcoming. And until they come in the office and you see that their BUN is like 65 and they've been having profuse watery diarrhea but decided not to tell you, I try to make it a point that if you don't tell us, you don't get treated, so you're better off telling us so we can try and keep you on schedule. So what are the early signs? Well, GI toxicity is increased number of bowel movements and abdominal bloating. Again, these people don't have to move quickly onto colitis. There are some patients who will just wake up one morning and call me and say, listen, I've just had 12 bowel movements in 1 hour. What do I do? Most patients will go through the process of increased stooling and increased flatulence, and these are the patients that you can modify diet and take out the roughage from their diet and also give them anti-motility drugs such as Imodium or Lamotil, and that may be able to calm it down where you don't need to go to steroids. The lung patients, if they're developing pneumonitis, again, it's the exertional dyspnea. You can certainly check an O2 sat in your office. But the most common complaint in patients that I've seen who develop pneumonitis is, I'm going up a flight of stairs with the groceries and I can't make it to the top without getting winded. Most common complaint. Skin, patients start to say they have increased sensitivity. So not necessarily itching, not necessarily a rash. Their skin feels just very sensitive, particularly at night and particularly in hot weather. And again, the endocrinopathies, depending on which endocrinopathy is in the process of developing, depends on which symptoms the patients will present with. The most common complaint is fatigue, but fatigue can encompass hypopit, it can encompass hypothyroidism, it can encompass adrenal insufficiency, so you have to be able to sort that out. So how do we evaluate treatment responses? And I'm going to shift gears because I was asked to talk about toxicity and also it's something called pseudoprogression because it's very unique to the immunotherapies. So how do we determine whether or not someone is responding to immunotherapy? Well, either they have an immediate response, which you sometimes see with the anti-PD-1 inhibitors, not so much with the anti-CTLA-4 antibodies, the anti-CTLA-4 antibodies, as you know, usually take between, 12 and 24 weeks, sometimes longer for patients to respond. The anti-PD-1 agents cause a much faster response in patients. What happens if the tumor just stops growing? Well, I tell patients, just like a speeding train, you can't throw the train into reverse and make it go backwards. You got to stop it first. So very much like this, if you are effective in stopping the cancer, there's a pretty good chance that you may be able to get it to regress on your next scan. And so you just sit and watch. And sitting and watching is probably one of the most frustrating things for patients and physicians because they want to know, how do you know it's going to get better? And the answer is you don't. But you also don't want to burn a bridge, which is what I tell them, without making sure that the bridge is really worth burning. You want to make sure that they're really not having a response and are just not going on to a delayed response. So tumor regression subsequent to your radiology, well, that's nice. If you see tumors shrinking up before you get your CAT scans, well, that's a home run. And many patients who have cutaneous melanomas will have palpable tumors and palpable lymphadenopathy where you're going to know even before the patient gets scanned whether or not they're responding or not. But then we're going to talk about something called pseudoprogression where the patient actually gets better and feels better. Their pain is under better control. They start to gain weight, but their radiographic images really look pretty horrible. And so this is pseudoprogression. And this happens relatively commonly. Probably about 20% of patients will develop either new tumors or their tumors will enlarge either clinically. Patients, again, who have cutaneous tumors can watch their tumors grow, and you'll watch them grow, and you'll have patients come in who, after their second cycle, will come in with brand new tumors. Some of their tumors may actually be exacerbated by therapy, so they'll be showing what we call a tumor flare. So these palpable or visual lesions will now become red, hot, and painful. They'll also increase in size, demonstrating an inflammatory response. And patients, as long as patients understand what's happening, that this is an inflammatory response, that this is not necessarily a bad thing, they're okay with it. But the key to determining what pseudoprogression is really looking at the patient, and it's not a textbook answer as to who does well and who doesn't do well. You have to look at what's happening with that patient. And like I said, when you give patients immunotherapy, you have to make a decision when it comes to imaging. And so you're going to be faced with three case scenarios. Either the patient is going to be doing really well and the scans are going to look really well, and then it's a no-brainer. You know exactly what's going on. The patient's responding. You keep going. If the patient declines physically, is losing weight, performance status is going down, has all these new tumors, and the scans also say that the tumors have progressed, well, bad and bad pretty much equals bad. No, that's not pseudoprogression, and that I think that's really important that clinicians need to understand that that's a bad thing. You need to move on. That bridge is burned. But the case of when the patient does better, starts to feel better, will actually come in and say, hey, doc, something's different. I feel better. I can't put my finger on it, but I feel better. But the radiographic scans look worse. You have to sit on them. They will respond. That's what's called pseudoprogression. I have some pictures here to show you that. And so this is a patient who was on a clinical trial, and you can see here that these are the cutaneous tumors that the patient has on their chest wall. Here again, Here's the chest wall tumors here. This is the CAT scan demonstrating all the subcutaneous masses. This is at week 12. So this is a patient who was on one of our ipilimumab trials. Again, tumor progression. And you can see clearly this tumor mass is much bigger than this tumor mass. But then 4 weeks later, everything's starting to flatten out. CAT scan's looking better. And here you are at week 72 with complete resolution of disease and a completely normal CAT scan. So again, just an example of really what pseudoprogression looks like. And again, same thing can happen on the inside with liver. This is our pretreatment liver. You can see tiny little gray spots in there. And if you don't believe me, use your imagination. That are consistent with very small liver mets. Patient got treated with ipilimumab, and now the liver metastases became very, very obvious and evident. However, patient was continued to be followed, and again, decrease in disease, and each scan continues to get better. So, again, this is just kind of a summary slide of what happens. Bad and bad equals bad, good and good equals good. Patient better, scans bad, that's probably a good thing. And it will translate over time. And so what's important, especially during a clinical trial, using all these new immunotherapies, we've clearly embarked into an area that is very foreign to most medical oncologists. I was fortunate enough to be a melanoma oncologist and started working with the anti-CTLA-4 antibodies back in 2001. So this I do in my sleep. However, most medical oncologists, this is brand new territory. Especially on a clinical trial, when in doubt, you're always better to overreport than to underreport. As we move into new agents, new toxicities are most likely to occur that we're not expecting. And so if you can't explain an adverse event based on a physiologic problem the patient's having or a tumor, because of tumor, you're always better off to overreport than underreport. Again, we learned this through the past trials where we also know that we needed to report progression and that patients would eventually wind up with pseudoprogression. We were allowed to keep patients on study if they actually progressed because we felt that this might be pseudoprogression, and so they were allowed to be continued past a response. And my office drive-by, my answer is, when in doubt, have the patient come in and take a look. Like I said, patients are very bad reporters. They either completely over-report or they completely under-report. I've never found an effective reporter in my 20 years of doing this. And so I like to just have them stop in so we can see, for example, the lady who had Stevens-Johnson. If I didn't make that lady come in, she would have died because she reported to me that her rash was exactly the way her rash was on Friday. In fact, I was so concerned about her, and I couldn't even tell you why. I called her over the weekend, and I called her on Friday. And I was like, how's your rash? And she said to me, you're harassing me. I am seeing you on Monday. I am hanging up. And I was like, okay, I guess she's okay. Much to my dismay, she came in and wound up going to the burn unit at Cornell and actually did survive. So in conclusion, I hope I've been able to show you that with the emergence of immunotherapy, the adverse events and the ways that we manage and assess toxicity as well as tumor responses is very different than the way we've done for chemotherapy in the past. You really need to have a very well managed office with good infrastructure to be able to manage the toxicities effectively and minimize patient toxicity because of lack of effective and prompt management. Patients and families, as well as physicians, also need to know about pseudoprogression and what's really pseudoprogression and what's really clinical progressive disease, because that's a problem that I get called with a lot from community docs, is that the patient is getting worse and the tumor is getting worse, but I think they're having a flare. No, they're not having a flare. They're having disease progression. If the patient was doing well and the scan looked bad, that's one thing. But if you're watching a bad scan and you're watching a patient deteriorate, it's time to change therapy. And I really truly believe that we've now turned the corner and immunotherapy is going to be the cornerstone for all of our cancer therapies moving forward. And we're going to see a big difference in the next 10 years. Thank you.
My thanks again goes out to Dr. Anna Pavlik, Director of the Melanoma Program at the NYU Cancer Institute. For more information about the IO360 program, please visit www.theconferenceforum.org. Thank you.